draws featuring prizes from local businesses including Old Farm Fine Foods, The Screening Room, Smokes Poutinerie, Studio 330, Tango Nuevo, Terra Natural Foods, The Toucan, The Wit, and YGK Thrift. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via CFRC.ca.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The country as a whole is paralyzed, and we wanted to finish this and to have a ceasefire. Hopefully, tonight, by tonight, we will have this ceasefire.
As calls grow for a ceasefire in Lebanon, we'll look at how Israel used U.S. weapons to kill three Lebanese journalists last month and what Human Rights Watch has called an apparent war crime. We'll go to Beirut. Then we speak to the head of Amnesty International USA about the group's call for President Biden to grant clemency to Native American leader Leonard Peltier, who has spent nearly half a century in prison.
Would allow me to put up a defense and manufactured evidence, manufactured witnesses, tortured witnesses.
Ready, Warden. A new short documentary about the execution of death row prisoner John Henry Ramirez.
John asked me, would you be my godmother? He is just not that person he was then.
Due process was done. Now we're changing our moral judgment.
What will you gain if I die? If I sink into the grave?
You're gonna just forgive and that's it? He should pay for what he did.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military is continuing to bomb southern Lebanon and the capital, Beirut, even as Israel's security cabinet meets to discuss a ceasefire proposal with Hezbollah. On Monday, a massive explosion rocked residential buildings in Beirut's southern suburbs following an Israeli warning on the social media site X for people to evacuate or face death. Similar Israeli attacks killed at least 31 people across Lebanon in just 24 hours. The continuing assault came as Lebanon's foreign minister said he hopes Israeli leaders will agree to a ceasefire later today. Under the deal, the Israeli military would withdraw from southern Lebanon within 60 days, while Lebanon's army would deploy to border areas from which Hezbollah has launched rocket attacks on Israel. In Brussels, the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, called for more pressure on extremist members of the Israeli government who are unwilling to forge a ceasefire.
In Lebanon, there is no excuses for a ceasefire. On the proposal agreement brokered by the U.S. and France, Israel has all security concerns. There is not an excuse for not implementing a ceasefire. Otherwise, Lebanon will fall apart.
Josep Borrell also called on EU member states to honor the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the former defense minister Yoav Gallant for crimes against humanity and war crimes committed in Gaza. Borrell cited widespread support for an ICC arrest warrant against Russian President Vladimir Putin over war crimes committed in Ukraine.
Cannot applaud when the court goes against Putin and remain silent when the court goes against Netanyahu.
That's Josep Borrell speaking in Italy at the G7 summit. Syria's government says Israeli airstrikes on Monday injured at least two people and damaged several bridges in Homs province near the Lebanese border. The Israeli military said it had targeted Iranian weapons smuggling routes through Syria to Hezbollah. In Gaza, health officials report Israeli strikes killed at least 14 Palestinians and wounded 108 others over the latest 24-hour period. One strike hit a family home in northern Gaza's Jabalia. another tour through a crowd of people gathered near a bakery in Gaza City. The latest killings came as Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, told a conference of Israeli settlers Gaza's population of more than 2.1 million should be drastically reduced. In remarks translated by Haaretz, Smotrich said, quote, "It is possible to create a situation where Gaza's population in 2 years will be less than half its current size." Smotrich has called for Israel to effectively annex the West Bank and Gaza Strip and has called for the establishment of large new Israeli settlements. Here in the United States, Special Counsel Jack Smith has dropped all federal charges against Donald Trump for illegally retaining classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago estate and for attempting to overthrow the 2020 election. In a six-page motion, Smith wrote, "The Justice Department cannot prosecute a sitting president." He added, quote, "That prohibition is categorical and does not turn on the gravity of the crimes charged, the strength of the government's proof, or the merits of the prosecution, which the government stands fully behind," unquote. Smith asked to dismiss the charges without prejudice, leaving the door open to a future prosecution of Trump after he leaves office in January 2029. Smith asked that the classified documents case against Trump's co-defendants, Walt Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira, be allowed to continue. A Washington Post investigation last year found Attorney General Merrick Garland allowed more than a year to pass before prosecutors and FBI agents jointly embarked on a formal probe of Trump's efforts to steal the 2020 election. President-elect Trump vowed on Monday to impose a 25% tariff on all goods from Mexico and Canada and to add a 10% tariff to all goods from China on the first day of his second presidential term. The move could undo Trump's own 2018 trade deal, the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. Economists warn such tariffs could severely hamper trade and industry and result in higher costs for consumers already struggling to make ends meet. In immigration news, Trump's pick for so-called border czar, Tom Homan, threatened to cut off federal funding for sanctuary states that refuse to comply with the Trump administration's plan for mass deportations. He spoke on Fox News.
And look, I've seen these, some of these Democratic governors say they're going to stand in the way. They're going to make it hard for us. Well, a suggestion: if you're not going to help us, get the hell out of the way, because we're going to do it.
A new report on Trump's cabinet picks estimates their combined net worth at a whopping $344.4 billion, more than the gross domestic product of 169 countries. Elon Musk, who Trump named to head up his planned Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, is worth $332 billion. Meanwhile, one of Trump's top advisors, Boris Epstein, was found by Trump's legal team to have solicited bribes from potential political appointees in exchange for promoting them in Trump's orbit. Russia's military says it's captured the village of Kopanki in Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region, adding to Russian forces' largest advances in Ukraine since the early days of the 2022 invasion. Overnight, most of Ukraine's territory was under air raid alerts as Russia launched its largest drone attack of the war. In the city of Kharkiv, a Russian missile attack injured 23 people, causing fires and widespread damage to residential buildings. Meanwhile, Ukrainian drones reportedly hit a fuel depot in the Russian region of Kaluga, more than 100 miles from Ukraine's border. This comes as the independent Russian news outlet Mediazona and the BBC Russian service reported the number of Russian soldiers who've died in Ukraine has topped 78,000, though the journalists estimate the true toll could be double that number. A similar analysis found 65,000 Ukrainian combat deaths. In Romania, the far-right nationalist Calin Georgescu shocked pollsters as he gathered the highest number of votes, around 23%, in the country's presidential election, knocking Prime Minister Marcel Ciolacu out of the race. He'll stand in a runoff vote on December 8th against center-right candidate Elena Lasconi. Georgescu is a far-right critic of NATO who's praised Russia. His popularity soared in recent weeks as he rallied hundreds of thousands of followers on the social media site TikTok. On Monday, Romanian students in Bucharest rallied against Georgescu and the rise of the far right in Romanian politics.
I'm here because I believe in democracy. I believe that people should have a say in what's happening in their country. And I believe that going back to 35 years ago is not a solution to the problems we are facing right now.
In Pakistan, security forces have fired live bullets and tear gas as thousands of supporters of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan breached barriers and defied a lockdown to rally in the capital Islamabad, demanding Khan's release. Pakistan's army has been deployed in parts of the city. Four paramilitary rangers and two police officers were killed in clashes. Ahead of the planned rallies, police detained over 4,000 supporters of Imran Khan and his PTI party. Back in the United States, ProPublica has reported on another pregnant woman in Texas who died after she was denied appropriate treatment. Health providers say it's clear 35-year-old Portia Ngumezi needed emergency DNC, or dilation and curettage, after she started bleeding heavily at 11 weeks pregnant, but was instead given the pill misoprostol. While many doctors in states with abortion bans have started avoiding DNC, a common and life-saving procedure, the Houston Methodist Hospital also abides by its own religion-based ethics guidelines that restricted abortion procedures even before Roe v. Wade was overturned. It's the fifth case ProPublica has reported in which pregnant women died after being refused the most effective emergency care following state abortion bans. Three of those cases were in Texas. Portia Ngumezi leaves behind her husband and two young sons. In France, prosecutors are requesting the maximum 20-year jail sentence for Dominique Pellicot, a man who for over a decade drugged his wife, Giselle Pellicot, and invited dozens of men to rape her while she was unconscious. Some of the other defendants in the case, including those accused of raping Ms. Pellicot, could receive sentences from 10 to 17 years. Giselle Pellicot, who chose to reveal her identity to give a voice to other survivors, has emerged as a symbol of courage and women's rights in France. And in related news, a new study finds 1 in 3 women in the European Union has experienced gender-based violence in their lifetime. In Spain, thousands of protesters, some donning white masks, marched through Madrid Monday, the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women.
We're here to denounce the male chauvinist violence we suffer, which, of course, are the femicides. We've had more than 80 in the Spanish state throughout the year, regrettably, but also the wage gap. We suffer job precariousness and many other things that we are denouncing today. For example, the military budgets and the militarization of borders or the genocide in Palestine. We have that in mind, too, at this demonstration.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Lebanon, where Israel's killed at least 31 people over the past 24 hours ahead of a possible ceasefire. Israel's security cabinet's expected to vote today on a ceasefire proposal. One Saudi news outlet has reported President Biden and French President Emmanuel Macron will announce a 60-day ceasefire in Lebanon later today. Under the deal, the Israeli military would withdraw from southern Lebanon within 60 days, while Lebanon's army would deploy to border areas from which Hezbollah has launched rocket attacks on Israel. According to Israeli officials, the proposed deal would allow Israel to continue to operate inside Lebanon to remove what it views as threats by Hezbollah. Lebanon's foreign minister, Abdullah Bouhabib, spoke earlier today in Rome.
The country as a whole is paralyzed, and we wanted to finish this and to have a ceasefire. Hopefully, by tonight, we will have this ceasefire.
Since October last year, Israel's killed over 3,750 people in Lebanon, with most of the deaths occurring over the past 10 weeks. The Israeli attacks have forced more than 1 million people to flee their homes in Lebanon. About 60,000 people in northern Israel have also been displaced. Israel's also targeted journalists in Lebanon. In a new report, Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of committing an apparent war crime by killing 3 journalists and injuring 4 others last month. On October 25th, Israel bombed the Hasbaya Village resort in southern Lebanon, where more than a dozen journalists had been staying. The attack killed Ghassan Najjar, a journalist and cameraman, Mohammed Reda, a satellite broadcast engineer, both from Al Mayadeen TV, and Wissam Qasem, a cameraman from Al Manar TV. Human Rights Watch has revealed Israel used an airdrop bomb equipped with a U.S.-produced Joint Direct Attack Munition Guidance Kit. To talk more about this new report and the latest in Lebanon, we're joined in Beirut by Ramzi Kais, Lebanon researcher for Human Rights Watch. Ramzi, thank you so much for being with us. Go back to that day of the killing of the three journalists and tell us what you have reconstructed, what you understand took place.
Hi, Amy. I couldn't hear the question very clearly, just parts of it, but I'm currently in Beirut. I came back yesterday evening, and just landing into Beirut, you could see plumes of smoke rising from Beirut's southern suburbs. And just a few minutes ago, before showing up into this studio, there had been strikes on central Beirut, about a kilometer to 2 kilometers away. And just a few minutes ago as well, there had been 20 evacuation warnings that had been given to various buildings in Beirut's southern suburbs, or Dahi. You might know that we're currently ceasefire negotiations are ongoing, the results of which are still not clear. There's a sense of cautious optimism from U.S. officials and Lebanese officials. But as things stand now, and especially in the past few days, there has been dozens of strikes across Beirut, across the south, across the entire country. And so we'll have to wait and see what happens or unfolds. But the situation is very much one of war still. And we're currently looking at, you know, over 3,700 people killed in Lebanon. This includes over 240 children. It includes over 222 health workers, over 700 women, more than 40 hospitals damaged. And what the World Report, what the World Health Organization says, is over 10% of Lebanese hospitals have been either ceased to operate or are partially functioning, and where more than 47% of attacks on health care workers have been fatal.
Ramzi, and if you could go back in time and tell us, reconstruct for us the day that the three journalists were killed.
Yeah, so our investigation looked into the attack that took place on October 25, 2024. And what we found, that there was an Israeli strike on the southern Lebanese town of Hasbaya, on a resort where at least more than a dozen journalists had been staying in the early hours of the day. It killed at least three journalists and injured at least four others. We found that this attack was most likely a deliberate attack on civilians and an apparent war crime. We also found that the attack was conducted using an airdrop bomb with a U.S.-produced guidance kit, a Joint Direct Attack Munition, or a JDAM. Human Rights Watch researchers had visited the site of the attack. They had identified the remnants that were used as part of the attack. This included a remnant that was made by the U.S. company Boeing, in addition to another remnant with it that bore a numerical code that identified it as being produced by the U.S. company Woodward. As part of our investigation, we spoke to at least eight people, including three journalists who were injured in the attack, including the owner of the resort where their journalists had staying. We found that there was no military activity that was happening in the immediate area of the attack. There were no military forces or fighting. The journalists had been staying at the site since at least October 1, so at least 25 days before the strike happened, and they had made routine and repeated trips daily to in the town of Hasbaya to nearby Hilltop, where they were doing live reports. The hotel owner had told Human Rights Watch that the journalists had left and come back approximately the same time every day. Most of the cars that were present at the site were marked by press or TV. All of this together leads us to the conclusion that the Israeli military knew or should have known that the site, the targeted building that was being struck, was one that contained journalists. Journalists are civilians, and deliberately targeting journalists is a war crime. The Israeli military initially, after the strike, said that they struck a building where terrorists were operating, but a few hours later, they said that the incident is under review. And this is not the first time that we have documented the unlawful killing of journalists. We had previously documented an apparently deliberate attack on October 13th that killed Reuters journalist Aysam Abdullah. It is also not the first time that we are documenting the use of U.S. weapons unlawfully in Lebanon. We had previously documented the unlawful use of U.S. weapons to kill aid workers, that killed aid workers in earlier this year. And once again, we're seeing them being used unlawfully, and this time journalists were the ones that, that paid the price.
And Ramzi, about those the use of U.S. weapons, what are you calling for specifically of the U.S. government?
Yes, we're calling on the U.S. government to suspend arms sales and military assistance to Israel, given that these weapons are being used unlawfully. We're also calling on U.S. companies to end arms sales, recall already sold weapons wherever possible, and stop all support services for already sold weapons. In this case, U.S. weapons were used unlawfully in a deliberate attack on civilians, and for which U.S. officials may be complicit in. And so there's a responsibility that the U.S. has under its own laws, but also under international law, to suspend arms sales where there's a real threat, a real risk that these weapons will be used unlawfully.
We've also seen in recent days the International Criminal Court issue arrest warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant over war crimes in Gaza. Does the court have jurisdiction over crimes committed in Lebanon?
The court does not, and in fact, one of the main calls that the Human Rights Watch has been making is on the Lebanese government to provide the International Criminal Court with the jurisdiction to investigate crimes within its jurisdiction on Lebanese territory, regardless of who the perpetrator of these violations are. Lebanon is not a signatory to the Rome Statute, but may provide the court with jurisdiction to investigate such crimes within its jurisdiction. We have previously made this call in relation to other investigations that Human Rights Watch has conducted. In April of this year, the government took this decision instructing the foreign ministry to provide the court with jurisdiction under Article 12.3 of the Rome Statute, but the foreign ministry never acted on the decision, and the government eventually reversed that decision, unfortunately. So currently, there needs to be a pathway for accountability in Lebanon. This is where the Lebanese government has a really significant role to play that it has not yet. We're also calling on the Lebanese government to convene or call for the convening of a special session at the UN Human Rights Council in order to establish an international fact-finding mechanism that can investigate, document, collect evidence, and report on its findings in relation to violations of the laws of war in connection to the hostilities between Lebanon and northern Israel.
Ramzi Kayas, if you can talk about this possibility of a ceasefire and what exactly it would mean. You yourself live in Beirut, and how people would be affected. Does it mean there will be a mass flow of people back to their homes? What does all of this present, and how hopeful are the people of Lebanon right now?
Yeah, as I mentioned, there is some cautious optimism by U.S. officials, by Lebanese officials, about the possibility of a ceasefire. But as we speak, strikes are currently ongoing in Lebanon. They are ongoing in the southern suburbs of Beirut, but as well in central Beirut, where about a few minutes ago there had been a strike between 1 to 2 kilometers away. There have been ongoing repeated evacuation warnings for building in the southern suburbs of Beirut, and strikes are continued to be reported in South Lebanon and across the country. Whether a ceasefire or not takes place, the fact remains that in Lebanon, more than 3,700 people have been killed, more than 240 children, more than 220 health and rescue workers, more than 700 women. Entire border villages have been detonated, have been destroyed and reduced to rubble. And there has been significant damages to the country's health sector, with the large number of medical workers killed, the hospitals that have been damaged. It's not clear that many people in the south can return to their homes, given the vast damage that has happened, particularly in the border villages, where we have seen controlled demolitions, in some cases of entire villages, in some cases of large areas of those villages. We were speaking today with the mayor of one of the border villages, and he was expressing to us the anxiety that is had with returning returning to those villages because of what is not known. What is not known in terms of what is left of the villages, whether they're going to be able to recognize it, but also in terms of what weapon remnants remains. These are villages that have also been struck by white phosphorus. They've been struck by high explosive weapons. And so we have yet to see what will unfold with the ongoing ceasefire negotiations. But as things stand, and given the high toll of people killed, of civilian killed, there also needs to be accountability for violations of the laws of war that have taken place, that we have documented and that others have documented. This includes deliberate targeting of civilians, indiscriminate attacks on civilians, widespread use of white phosphorus, the unlawful attacks on civilian institutions, the use of booby trap devices. We'll have to wait and see what comes about with regards to the ceasefire negotiations, but as things stand, strikes are ongoing on the country.
And Ramzi, what do you make of this decision of the Israeli government, even as they are entertaining the possibility of a ceasefire, ramping up these attacks in the past few days? What's your sense of what their goal is here?
Yeah, it's not clear, right? I mean, there has been a serious escalation in the scale of attacks, particularly with regards to strikes on the southern suburbs. We've seen dozens of strikes on the southern suburbs. There's also been, you know, especially today with the evacuation warnings being issued to various buildings in the country, and in some cases, strikes happening without evacuation warnings. To me, it's not clear what all this message is. Hezbollah has also increased the number of rockets it has fired into Israel, with yesterday firing over 300 rockets into various areas of north and central Israel. It's not clear what this all means and whether the ceasefire will in fact take place. We'll have to wait and see. But you know, regardless, civilians are you know, unfortunately paying the price as more homes are being destroyed, or more buildings are being leveled, as more strikes are ongoing across the country.
Ramzi Kayas, we want to thank you for being with us, Lebanon researcher for Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Beirut. The latest report from Beirut, headline: U.S. arms used in Israeli strike on journalists, 3 killed, 4 injured in an apparent war crime. We'll link to it. When we come back, we'll speak to the head of Amnesty International USA. He wrote a letter urging President Biden to take bolder action before he leaves office, including granting clemency to Native American leader Leonard Peltier. He's been behind bars for half a century. Stay with us. February 8th by Pillow Queens. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Biden's facing calls to grant clemency to the jailed Native American leader Leonard Peltier. He spent nearly half a century in prison for a crime he says he did not commit. Leonard Peltier recently turned 80 years old. He's always maintained his innocence over the 1975 killing of 2 FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. His supporters say his conviction was riddled with irregularities and prosecutorial misconduct. In a moment, we'll speak to the head of Amnesty International USA. But first, I want to turn to a video Amnesty produced about Peltier's case. It's narrated by the actor Peter Coyote.
I am everyone who ever died without a voice, or a prayer, or a hope, or a chance.
Leonard Peltier is a Native American activist who has been in prison for more than 46 years, serving 2 consecutive life terms for a crime he maintains he did not commit. In 1977, he was convicted of killing two FBI agents, Ronald Williams and Jack Kohler, during a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Peltier was a member of the American Indian Movement, AIM, founded in 1968 during the Civil Rights Movement to advocate for the rights of Native Americans. The murders occurred at a time when AIM supporters and residents of Pine Ridge were being intimidated and killed, allegedly by paramilitaries connected to the government. A climate of fear and terror prevailed. After two AIM members were acquitted of the killings, the FBI coerced witnesses into saying they saw Peltier shoot the agents. Ballistics evidence that could have aided Leonard's defense was hidden from his lawyers.
The only thing I'm guilty of is struggling for my people. I didn't kill those agents.
It was not a fair trial. The conclusion reached by Federal Appeals Judge Gerald Heaney, who stated the prosecution withheld evidence favorable to the defendant, and the FBI used improper tactics in extraditing Peltier and otherwise in investigating and trying Peltier's case.
I'll be an old man when I get out. If I get out.
Leonard Peltier spent more than 46 years in prison, some of which was in solitary confinement. He is now 78 years old and in rapidly declining health. There are concerns that he is not receiving adequate medical treatment and his condition could be fatal.
They're giving him the death penalty by leaving in that type of an environment. The man needs medical treatment. He needs to have access to medical treatment. If they're not going to give medical treatment to him, they need to release him as soon as possible.
Amnesty International is calling on President Biden to grant Leonard Peltier clemency before it's too late. President Biden has a chance to rectify a case that has troubled many people for decades.
A video produced by Amnesty International about the in-jailed indigenous leader Leonard Peltier, who on September 12th turned 80 years old. Peltier supporters are hoping President Biden will grant Peltier clemency before he leaves office in January. 24 years ago, President Clinton faced similar calls. On Election Day 2000, I spoke to Bill Clinton when he called into our Pacifica radio station, WBAI, to get out the vote. I asked him about Peltier's case.
President Clinton, since it's rare to get you on the phone, let me ask you another question. That is, what is your position on granting Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist, executive clemency?
Well, I don't have a position I can announce yet. I believe there is a new application for him in there. And when I have time after the election's over, I'm going to review all the remaining executive clemency applications. And, see what the merits dictate. I will try to do what I think the right thing to do is based on the evidence.
That was President Clinton almost a quarter of a century ago. In 2012, I had a chance to speak to Leonard Peltier by phone. At the time, Barack Obama was president. Leonard, this is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. I was wondering if you have a message for President Obama.
I just hope he can, stop the wars that are going on in the world and stop getting killing all those people getting killed and give the Black Hills back to my people and turn me loose.
Can you share with people at the news conference and with President Obama your case for why you should be, your sentence should be commuted, why you want clemency?
Well, I never got a fair trial, for one. They wouldn't allow me to put up a defense and manufactured evidence, manufactured witnesses, tortured witnesses. The list just goes on. So I think I'm a very good candidate for after 37 years for clemency or house arrest, at least.
That That was Leonard Peltier speaking to me in 2012. We're joined now by Paul O'Brien, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. He recently wrote to President Biden urging him to take a number of actions before leaving office, including granting clemency to Leonard Peltier. We're going to go through your demands, Paul O'Brien, but let's start with Leonard Peltier, who has been in prison for almost half a century now. Why are you calling for him to be released?
Hi, Amy, and thank you for your steadfast work on Leonard's case over the decades. Like Amnesty, we have been calling on administration after administration to do the right thing by Leonard. He was in hospital in June. He was in hospital again in October. It's time to give him a chance to spend his last days with his family and with his community. He's been incarcerated as long as Joe Biden has been in national politics, and we all know how long that is. President Biden doesn't have to pardon him. He just has to give him clemency so that he can spend those last days with the right people. And he can send an important signal to the Native American community that will fracture some of the divisions that are still felt over these issues.
And Paul, for those people who are not familiar, could you explain the difference between the pardon and clemency?
Well, clemency doesn't have to pass a ruling on the actual decision. It simply is an act of compassion by the president to say he has served enough time. As you said on the earlier piece, this has essentially become death penalty through incarceration. And if President Biden, who says he's opposed to the death penalty, wants to do the right thing by Leonard, he will say 50 years is enough. It's time to let him spend his last days with his family.
Painful to watch. I was just going to say, Juan, it was painful to watch yesterday. I mean, it's become this tradition over the last few decades for the president, right, to pardon turkeys. And yes, President Biden was out pardoning turkeys. I think they were peach and blossom yesterday at the White House, sparing their lives. But talk about the seriousness of this, Paul O'Brien, as you talk about a signal to the Native American community. President Biden just went to Arizona to ask forgiveness for the U.S. history of how they have treated Native Americans in residential schools. Leonard Peltier was in one of those schools.
That's right. Right now, it feels to many of the folks that we're talking to that the relationship between this administration and Native American leadership is really fractured. And this would send such a positive signal. Some time ago, I stood alongside some of those leaders outside the White House calling for Leonard's release. Many of us were arrested on that day, and the administration simply refused to hear what these remarkable leaders in the Native American community are saying, which is, if you want to show that you are genuinely committed to healing this relationship, you will take steps on Leonard's behalf. So far, nothing.
And Paul, I wanted to ask you about other things you mentioned in your letter, the issue of those folks on death row for federal crimes. Under President Trump's first term, he oversaw the execution of 13 death row inmates, executing the most federal death row inmates of any president in more than a century. Talk about who is awaiting a death sentence now.
Thanks. Yes. And those 13 executions happened in President Trump's last 6 months. That's what may be coming if we don't see President Biden taking action now. So right now, there are 44 men still on federal and military death row. One of those cases, Billy Allen, he was 19 when he committed a crime in 1998. There were deep flaws in his case, no DNA evidence, clear racism in his case, and yet at the age of 47, more than half his life, he's still there. So what we are asking President Biden to do is something he said he was going to work on in 2020. He said he was going to abolish the death penalty. All he's done is put a moratorium during his administration, but that won't mean anything once his administration ends. President Trump can simply end that moratorium and return to what he was doing at the end of his administration. So we need President Biden to commute those 44 sentences now.
Also, President-elect Trump has vowed to reinstate the Remain in Mexico policy. In what ways could President Biden help restore asylum at the border before his term ends?
Well, this is probably the greatest human rights crisis that is coming at us now, because President Trump has made clear he is going to immediately start engaging in mass deportations. President Biden, again, promised a human rights approach to immigration, and he has singularly failed to do so. In June, he passed an executive order which effectively shut down the U.S.-Mexico border and created this numerical cap on the number of people who can seek asylum. There are many very specific things that he can do. During his administration, he set up the CBP One app. This is an app that people on the border can use to apply. I went down there and met with women, often mothers of young children, living in tents, waiting for this app to tell them when they could legally apply to enter the United States. And they were waiting month after month with no news. What he could do immediately is speed up the CBP One app process to get more people to legally apply for asylum, particularly for vulnerable populations. But he could do so much more as well in these last couple of months. He could immediately stop expanding detention centers. He could shut down problematic detention centers and end the contracts of the companies that are running them. He could order the release of vulnerable populations who are in detention. He still has time to surge resources to address some of the backlogs that are now being experienced. And everything that he doesn't do is going to make it easier for President Trump to fulfill his promises to initiate the biggest deportation in history.
Paul O'Brien, you've also called for the closing of Guantanamo. Explain.
It's time, Amy. There are still 30 men there. President Biden has a window of opportunity right now. He can transfer all the detainees that are still there, already cleared for release, not charged with crimes, to countries where their human rights will be respected. He can halt unfair military commissions and help to resolve the pending cases that are there. All this can be done if he commits to closing Guantanamo once and for all during his last days in office. It can be done.
Finally, Gaza. Paul O'Brien, you're executive director of Amnesty International USA. You've said change course on Gaza, stop arms transfers to the government of Israel in order to protect civilians and ensure U.S. weapons are not being used in violation of international law. Senator Bernie Sanders, in the largest collection of U.S. senators, several dozen U.S. senators, they voted to stop arming Israel, but that wasn't enough. It wasn't the majority of the Senate, Paul.
That's right. And this is what the United States must do now, and President Biden must show more leadership on this. It's been weak rhetoric and weaker action since October 7th of 2023. He needs to send a clear message that the United States is no longer going to arm the killing of civilians in indiscriminate attacks that we have documented time and again over the last more than a year now. He needs to use his remaining leverage to get a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. He needs to open up humanitarian access. And these will be the bases, we believe, and he needs to call for the safe return of those remaining hostages. What is happening now to the Palestinian people has happened on President Biden's watch, and he needs to take action to protect innocent lives in Gaza.
Paul O'Brien, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, will link to your letter urging President Biden to change course on critical human rights before end of term. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. When we come back, we look at a new short documentary about the execution of a Texas death row prisoner. It's called I'm Ready, Warden. Stay with us.
Connection is shaking. audio drops, the video's there. It's never enough. There's no substitute for touching your face. There's not much to say. Shelter in place. Our love has survived hard times before. When I think of your face, love has endured. I'm willing to wait.
Willing to Wait by Evan Greer, musician and director of Fight for the Future. Greer confronted Republican Congress member Nancy Mace last week at an internet conference over Mace's anti-trans bigotry. Tune in tomorrow on Democracy Now! When we speak with Chase Strangio of the ACLU. He's set to make history next week, the first trans attorney to argue a case before the Supreme Court. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at a short new documentary about the death penalty that began when a Texas man asked journalist Kerry Blackinger to witness his execution. John Henry Ramirez was a former Marine who'd been sentenced to die for the 2004 murder of a convenience store clerk named Pablo Castro in Corpus Christi, Texas. Ramirez at first asked for a death sentence, saying he deserved it. He admitted he committed the crime. While on death row, he became a devout Christian. He sued for the right to have his pastor lay hands on him when he was ultimately executed in 2022. I Am Ready, Warden, examines the forces of redemption and vengeance by following Ramirez, as well as the son of his victim, Aaron Castro, and Ramirez's own son, Izzy, and his supporters. It premiered Friday on Paramount Plus and is directed by Smriti Mundra. This is the trailer.
We each have our own free will.
I'll never be able to make amends for taking a life. I'm a murderer.
I'll never overcome it.
I swear, Gene. I remember waking up to police sirens and lights and seeing my father's body on the ground.
This man stabbed somebody 29 times.
The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles unanimously denied clemency for John Henry Ramirez.
In the interest of justice, our office shouldn't be involved in murdering Texas citizens.
I just had all the anger and hate in the world.
They always said, I'm going to be a better father than my dad.
I don't think if I would have stayed free, you would have grown up to be who you are right now.
John asked me, would you be my godmother? He is just not that person he was then.
Due process was done. Now we're changing our moral judgment.
What will you gain if I die? If I sink into the grave?
You're going to just forgive and that's it? He should pay for what he did.
We made the most changes I could. I bettered myself as much as I could, and that's enough.
I love you.
I Am Ready, Warden offers remarkable access to John Henry Ramirez, who's interviewed on death row in the final weeks of his life. This is a clip of Ramirez.
One of the courses in the faith-based section, you have to write a letter to your victim. And when I got to the end, I was like, I want you to know you made me a better person. Yeah, I never meant to kill you, but because that happened, it's made me a better person because it's made some vast changes in who I am. You know, and it's a crappy way to say it, but it's the truth.
For more, we're joined in Houston, Texas by Kerry Blackinger, investigative journalist at the Los Angeles Times, where she covers the L.A. Sheriff's Department. She previously covered the criminal justice system for the Marshall Project, where her reporting on John Henry Ramirez led her to work with director Smriti Mundra on this new short documentary, I Am Ready Warden. She's the author of the memoir Corrections in Ink, which details Carrie's own experience serving time in prison in upstate New York. Carrie, welcome back to Democracy Now! This documentary is stunning. It is heartbreaking. Explain how you got involved and the story of this case. The guilt or innocence has been established. John Ramirez says, I murdered this store clerk.
Yeah, so as you said in your intro, the way that I got involved was because he asked the spokesman if I could be the reporter who would witness his execution. I was actually at death row visiting another person for an interview for a completely unrelated story, and the spokesman pulled me aside and said, hey, this guy, John Ramirez, asked if you could be the person who would witness his execution. And I was struck by that. I'd never gotten that sort of request from a person on death row. And so I said, you know what, I will at least put in a request for an interview and see what the story is and where it takes me. And that ended up leading to two stories. One was about one of the legal issues that he had pending, which was whether his pastor could lay hands on him as he was being executed. And that became a national media issue. I wrote a story about that. He also told me that he was participating in a death row radio station, which was a new initiative at that point, still going on. And it was where guys who were in general population were doing an inmate-run radio station that was low wattage and could really only be heard by other inmates on the unit. And they were allowing, the prison was allowing death row inmates to participate by writing to the guys who were running the station, and they could read their words on the air, which was really remarkable because the guys on death row had been in solitary for over two decades at that point and had very little direct interaction with general population people. And this was a rare chance for them to share their words with the broader prison population. But it was also kind of remarkable because it was a station that was run by inmates for inmates. So this is really a window into how they talked to each other when there's no one from the free world listening. And I wrote a story about that. And then Smirti, the director, read that story and said she was fascinated by this character, John Ramirez. And we ended up going down the path of just sort of talking to everyone in his life and everyone who was involved in his case and seeing where the story led us.
Carrie, in addition to Ramirez himself, you closely followed the son of his victim, Aaron Castro. But talk about his struggle with vengeance and redemption.
I think he ends up being the character per se who really makes the film, because I think that people, I think that the victims' families are told that executions will bring them closure. And I think that one of the things that we were able to explore in spending so much time with him is whether that is always the case or whether that is ever the case. And I think in his instance, we get to watch him grapple with that in some really remarkable moments on film. He was a really great person to be having on film because you can see his emotions are just right below the surface. And I think that makes him a very evocative character, as it were. I mean, obviously, he's a very real person who shows us some very raw moments of his life.
I wanted to go to another clip from I Am Ready Warden of the county district attorney, Mark Gonzalez, who moved to withdraw the death warrant for John Henry Ramirez, again convicted in 2004 in robbery and murder of Pablo Castro, a store clerk. Later in the clip, we also hear from Castro's son, from Aaron. This is the DA, Gonzalez.
I got with Mr. Ramirez's attorney, Seth Kretzer, and I joined him in a motion, letting the court know why we felt the date of execution should be withdrawn. What I'm hoping is we'll get some direction from a higher court, and they'll say that I have all the authority to withdraw that date of execution.
The proof is in the motion Gonzalez filed today. He's trying to get Ramirez's execution date withdrawn.
For a while now,
time to heal properly. Due process was done. Now we're changing our moral judgment. For us, the victims, we thought it was going to end with justice, right? And now ultimately we're looking at possibly no execution at all.
Again, that was Nueces County District Attorney Gonzalez calling for the vacating of the death warrant. Kerry Blakinger, if you can explain how he joined with John's attorney.
Yeah, this was such a legally interesting case. So John Ramirez had an execution date set in 2021, and that one got called off because of the pending legal issues over whether his pastor could lay hands on him as he was being executed. So that issue went up to the Supreme Court. When the Supreme Court sided with him and said, yes, the pastor can lay hands on you as you're being executed, that meant that he won that aspect of his case, but it also meant that he became eligible for an execution date again. In the interim, the district attorney, Mark Gonzalez, had come out saying that he was no longer in support of the death penalty. However, his office still ended up asking for an execution date, and he later said that that was because one of his assistant district attorneys had asked for it routinely without consulting him and without his knowledge. So at that point, Mark Gonzalez tried to have the date recalled, tried to have it called off, and this ended up turning into a months-long legal battle. And it turned out that the trial court judge, determined that he didn't have jurisdiction to just cancel a date for that reason. There are specific legal reasons in Texas that you can recall a date, and the district attorney changing his mind turns out not to be one of them.
And Kerry, you said in a podcast, the reporting this story sort of broke you. What did you mean by that, and what do you hope those who view the film take away from it?
So when I say that this story broke me, that actually the reasons for that didn't even end up in this film at all. But it was one of the most heartbreaking things I've seen interviewing him repeatedly over a period of months. The first time that I interviewed John Ramirez, we talked a lot about his faith because he had the pending appeals about his pastor. And he had this elaborate vision of an afterlife. And he was very firm in his faith. And his idea of this afterlife seemed to give him a lot of comfort when I was talking to him, which was a week before his scheduled execution date. Then that execution got called off, and I think he saw that as a confirmation of his faith in some ways. And then over the next few months, it ended up getting scheduled again. And then there was this protracted legal battle over whether it could be called off. And somewhere in there, I think all the back and forth really wore on him. And by the time that I saw him in, I don't know, the summer before he got executed, he had, you know, he seemed to be in a much darker place. And then I think the last time that I saw him, he started talking about how he hoped that he was wrong and that there wasn't this elaborate afterlife, and he just wished for blackness. And I'm not a person of faith, but watching someone lose not just their life, but like their afterlife, that just felt like one of the darkest things that I've seen in covering death row. So that's what I think about when I think about the ways in which this case has, you know, impacted or broken me.
And Kerry, in the last 30 seconds we have, speaking of impactful moments, when he says goodbye over the phone to his own son, Izzy.
Yes, that is, I mean, that is such a rare moment to be able to capture on film, and obviously such a raw moment. But I think it really makes the viewer think about the sort of circles of loss and trauma that come with every death row case and every execution, because, you know, there's no happy outcomes in this case, in this story, in this film.
Perry Blankinger, we thank you for being involved with, for producing this film. Investigative journalist, reporter at the LA Times. Her reporting on John Ramirez led to her work with the director, Smitri Mundra, on the new short documentary everyone should see called I Am Ready, Warden, now streaming on Paramount Plus. Author of the memoir Corrections and Ink, a memoir. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.